As a real estate manager, Principal Asset Management harnesses the power of a 360-degree perspective, delivering local insights and global expertise across public and private equity and debt. Their teams apply local insights and global perspectives to help identify the most compelling investing opportunities. Principal Asset Management, actively invested. Learn more at principalam.com. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Principal Asset Management SM is a trade name of Principal Global Investors LLC.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Hello, Oddlots listeners. Of course, normally we release new episodes on Monday, but today we're bringing you a special midweek episode. That's because it's a very timely one. Obviously, a lot of interest in the coronavirus and the effect that it's having on supply chains around the world. So we didn't want to wait. We didn't want to slot it in future in the schedule. We wanted to get it out now, and hopefully you enjoy. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Oddlots podcast. I'm Joe Weisenthal.
And I'm Tracy Alloway.
Tracy, you know what's really struck me in the markets over the last several weeks?
Go on.
Well, obviously, the crisis over the coronavirus continues to be this massive story for the global economy, for China, Asia, all kinds of different companies. And yet investors, in a weird way, outside of some specific names or specific currencies, still seem surprisingly, or maybe not surprisingly, but generally not that worried right now.
Yeah, I find this pretty amazing. So at the time that we're recording, I think the S&P 500 is still pretty close to its all-time high. And what amazes me about that is we spent 2 years collectively worrying about how trade tensions between the U.S. and China were going to affect global supply chains and economic growth and consumption. And we sort of followed every tiny in and out when it came to the trade negotiations. And now when you have something, the coronavirus and the containment efforts underway in China, you have something that is guaranteed to impact production and consumption in the world's second biggest economy, as well as disrupt a bunch of supply chains, and no one seems to care.
Yeah, it's really odd. It's really surprising. It's counterintuitive. It's not what I would have guessed. Even this week, the week that we're recording it, we got a warning from one of the sort of emblems of U.S.-China trade globalization, Apple, which is heavily exposed to China on the supply chain front and heavily exposed to China on the revenue front, saying, look, this quarter is going to be worse than we previously expected. Factories aren't opening up for our suppliers as fast as we had anticipated a couple of weeks ago. We're not totally sure when things will be back to normal, not to mention the fact that people are out less shopping. And, you know, the stock fell about 2% in the immediate wake of that, maybe because people figured this was the case already. And then the next day, the stock immediately basically erased all of those losses. So even a company coming out and saying, you know, this is a serious issue for us, even it's not having that much effect on them right now. I guess people are so confident that the effects will just be transitory and everyone will, okay, but be back to work eventually.
Yeah. And our colleagues over at Bloomberg Intelligence actually counted up the number of companies that are talking about the coronavirus at the moment. And I think they counted something like $9 trillion worth, or companies accounting for $9 trillion worth of market cap have mentioned the coronavirus. But so far, we only really have a handful of them who are issuing, you know, the kind of warnings that we saw from Apple. Most of them are just talking about how it's too early to say that, you know, they'll get a direct hit. But again, frankly, watching all of this go down in China and in Asia, I find it really difficult to see how global supply chains would not be impacted at this point.
Right. So obviously, look, we don't know what the markets are going to do, and nobody does, and we'll just see what happens. But I do think, and I did think, in light of that Apple warning, we really need to dive deeper into the question of supply chains, because so much of the world, so many companies that manufacture anything are exposed to China or East Asia in some way, and getting some sort of handle on what the risks are is key, and what the risks, of course, to the China economy are going to be. That's also key. So that's what we're going to discuss today.
Great. I think that's a good idea, given the circumstances. Let's do it.
All right. We have a really great guest. We've had him on the podcast, I think, a couple of times before, at least once, but I'm pretty sure twice. He's Dan Wang. He's an analyst at Gavcal Dragonomics. He's talking to us from Beijing. He's a tech analyst, really knows a lot about Chinese manufacturing, Chinese supply chains, the interaction with global tech. And he'll walk us through the risks posed by this virus, what we're seeing right now, as well as other risks that maybe people aren't even thinking about right now beyond the virus. So, Dan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me on again.
We've all seen the images of various cities across China, either quarantined or de facto quarantined, empty streets and so forth. We know that there are numerous factories that have yet to reopen, and the schedule for that is remains unclear. We got the warning this week from Apple that this is going to be a hit to their performance in the current quarter. So that's known. What to you, based on your work that you're doing, looking at the industry, what you've seen, what really jumps out at you in terms of the coronavirus hit to China's industrial economy?
So I think you've led by saying, in a really good way, by saying that basically the market seems to be brushing all of this off. I think there could be an economics way of thinking about that in just if you assume that the virus is going to be mostly contained in this current quarter, and you know, there's some evidence that that could be the case, and that the Chinese economy will basically bounce back into the normal previous trend growth that we were all expecting. There will be some pent-up demand that would be released later on, and it will be a quite bad quarter, but everything gets back to trend. I think that case could be made for the general macroeconomy, and that's why most people are not reacting very much. But in terms of electronics, I think that story would not be so simple. And that's because electronics manufacturing is involves some of the most complex supply chains ever. You need basically a lot of different components in place in order to begin production. You need 1,001 or maybe even 1,000,001 components all at the right place and all at the right time. And so if you have this delay, which hasn't really resolved itself yet, I think that can ripple on and cascade on throughout the supply chain all the way throughout the rest of the year when it comes to basically the peak selling season, which is the Christmas season in the U.S. I think that will ripple on throughout the rest of the year.
How much flexibility is there when it comes to altering global supply chains for electronics companies? Because, you know, during the trade tensions, we saw a lot of people talking about, well, they'll just move production from China to Vietnam or to wherever. There was that option. But in the current situation, it seems like, first of all, you'd have to do it much, much more quickly. And secondly, no one's really sure how the virus is going to play out, so you don't necessarily have the motivation to move production if you're thinking that it's going to end very, very quickly. So how easy is it to shift supply chains for electronics companies?
It is all pretty difficult, and we have not seen a great deal of production move overseas as a result of the U.S. tariffs on Chinese production. We have certainly seen some. I've seen a few marginal products, some things like servers and some things like wearables move overseas, especially to Vietnam. That's the most cited place, but in general, it hasn't been a wholesale movement of supply chain. And I think that's a pretty difficult thing for companies to deal with on a short term. A manufacturer made a statement a while ago to say that, you know, the tariffs are something that we can deal with. That's a cost increase, and that's something we have to enter into, but that is a predictable and something that we are able to resolve. Whereas if we do not have a lot of parts, as the coronavirus has threatened, if we do not have workers in our factories because they just are not coming back, or we cannot pass these sanitary checks or quarantine checks imposed by the local government, then we don't even have the parts in place to engage in production. So this seems like a much bigger deal.
Talk to us a little bit more about modern electronic supply chains. And in a sense, they're an absolute marvel because all these different companies come together and the logistics are such that companies can hold very little inventory, and the key part arrives just in time for the other company or the other manufacturer to assemble it into something, and then that goes into something else. And it's this sort of beautiful orchestra, maybe, when it's working ideally. Talk to us about what you said when you pointed out, look, it's not as simple as just restarting this. Because it's so complex, it's not just a matter of, okay, the switch goes off for a few weeks, and then maybe you just turn it back on. What is that cascading effect you're talking about, and why is it not so simple to get it going again once you're ready to restart?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So basically, to really get production going at a major manufacturer like Foxconn, you need a lot of different components in place. So you need, let's say, something like 1,000 components in place. You need all of the labor in place also to begin staffing. You need to make sure that all of the components are arriving on a daily basis, that there is a lot of flow. You need to make sure that the components are of pretty good quality, and you need to make sure that the labor is of good quality. And right now, basically, none of those conditions are holding. So Foxconn has not said publicly very much about how many workers have been able to return. Our estimate is that something like half of China's migrant labor force has arrived back into the factories. It's going to take quite a while, probably in March or early April, for everyone to get back into their place. And so, you know, I think that the larger manufacturers are probably able to deal with a lot of these problems. So Foxconn, in spite of a lot of bad press that has received over the last decade, is still the best paying of the large manufacturers. It has the best working conditions. It is just really large. It employs about 1 million people in China every year. And then the five other big contract manufacturers in Taiwan employ about collectively 500,000, so about 1.5 million people total working on just directly on all types of electronics, but especially the smartphone. And so basically, Apple needs a lot of people in place, and it should be able to hire all of the people that it needs. But if Foxconn is able to hire for everyone because it is working for its largest customer, Apple, which has a lot of cash to throw at these problems, it might suck away the labor from a lot of the sub-assemblers, so the component makers that are supplying goods for Foxconn to put onto lines of people to actually produce. So, you know, again, I want to emphasize that it only takes a few missing parts for an entire supply chain not to be functional. And so there will be a lot of these gaps out there, even for Apple. Apple every year launches a new iPhone by Q4. That is highly predictable. But even for Apple, it is a pretty hot affair. The supply chains are pretty tight, and every week counts towards Q4. And not very many firms have a few weeks of production to lose. So my thought here is that even though large manufacturers working for large consumer electronics companies like Apple are able to get through this, many smaller companies are going to have a lot more problems. Q1 is typically the time of the year where many consumer electronics companies engage in prototyping and development with the manufacturers. And if the manufacturers just have persistent labor shortages and supply shortages, they're going to be dedicating all of their people to their large customers like Apple. And I think the case would be here that this year the consumer electronics will be pretty bad. A lot of smaller companies won't even be able to launch the products they had hoped to launch by the Christmas season. That's already probably the case, and it's going to be a stretch even for Apple.
As a leading real estate manager, Principal Asset Management harnesses the power of a 360-degree perspective, delivering local insights and global expertise across public and private equity and debt. Our experienced teams are uniquely positioned to uncover compelling opportunities in today's market, giving our clients an exclusive advantage. Principal Asset Management actively invested. Learn more at principalam.com. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Principal Asset Management SM is a trade name of Principal Global Investors, LLC.
Could you talk to us a little bit more about the labor shortage idea and how the containment efforts that we've seen rolled out across China at this point, how those actually impact the way the labor market functions?
So China today has a lot of restrictions in place in who can go where. When I leave my apartment in Beijing, I have to flash this little card at these doormen who are newly set up to exit and enter the building. Every three blocks I go, there is someone taking my temperature to make sure that I'm all right. And one thing that I'm struck by now is that the amount of state capacity that China has brought to bear on this problem is impressive and also frightening that China has been able to quarantine about 60 million people around the population of Italy in the span of around 12 hours. My thought here is that China can mobilize its citizens more quickly than many countries can mobilize their armies. And so it is imposing many sorts of restrictions on labor, even today. Many migrants are not able to enter the large cities to actually begin production. So a lot of the public transportation in terms of trains are shut. A lot of cars are not able to go on the road. And this is creating a lot of problems for factories that really need labor. And I think the biggest issue here is that there's considerable uncertainty about when this virus could be declared eradicated and for everybody to feel safe to go back to their jobs. So these travel restrictions could evaporate, let's say, next week, or could take something longer, let's say a month, but it will take probably even longer for all of the flights to resume and for all of the people to feel that they can safely travel about in China. And that will create a lot of uncertainties. There is just a lot of human contact still required for to engage in production.
Yeah, and one of the things that we've seen anecdotally as well is this notion of a sort of patchwork of local and national rules. So, for instance, in order to open up a factory, you know, local officials will require the factory owner to give face masks to all of its workers. But of course, there's a giant face mask shortage, and so they're unable to do that. And we've seen a lot of chaos, let's say, and confusion when it comes to what the rules are and what they are not when it comes to work environments.
Right. Ken, trying to deal with that right around the holiday and, you know, the huge moves, extraordinary. Dan, is there a compounding effect of the delays such that, okay, you know, I know that at one point the goal was, okay, reopen by February 10th. That didn't happen in many cases. But is there a sort of nonlinearity where a week of delays does not just mean a week of problems, and each week the situation sort of snowballs and grows, compounds or grows exponentially?
Yes, there is that risk that there is a lot nonlinear aspect to this. If you were expecting basically a lot of components to arrive, and if you don't, then a lot of manufacturers could be quite stuck. And for the manufacturers like Foxconn, who are at the end of a supply chain, basically waiting for everybody to send everything through, they don't necessarily have great visibility into which little part they require that just doesn't necessarily make it. So every time there's an earthquake in Japan, it reminds us, reminds the world about how dependent the entire world is on perhaps a particular factory making a particular widget. And so these things can be a little bit unpredictable. But I think the large companies like Apple realize that at this point, and I think everybody is going to be in a scramble in the coming weeks to really understand how deep the supply chains are. Another issue for Apple right now is that Apple sends a lot of engineers from its headquarters in Cupertino to come over to China and then actually monitor, station these engineers and monitor the progress that these component makers have for quality assurance and product development purposes. A lot of those flights are canceled, and I expect that Apple is only able to send a trickle of staff over to China to actually monitor all of that production. So there are a lot of these risks out there.
Dan, talk to us a little bit about, I guess, the big picture long-term impact when it comes to China's technology ambition. So I think the first time we had you on this podcast was to talk about the Made in China 2025 initiative, where China is really trying to bulk up its own technology expertise. Would you expect something like the coronavirus outbreak to have a long-term impact on those efforts?
Certainly, I think it will push greater geographic diversity. I think that the events of the last 2 years have shown that companies are highly dependent on China for production. I think many companies are thinking more deeply about what geographic diversity actually means. So previously, we thought that geographic diversity, is important in case there's a flood or an earthquake, which are fairly localized events. And so if you want to basically have a more robust supply chain, you should locate a lot of your factories just geographically quite far away from each other. And I think the events, at least of the last year, have shown that when President Trump has imposed tariffs on Chinese goods, that there is a political element. So even if you produce in northern China and then southeastern China, you might still be hit by a lot of these same risks. Now, whether and how it impacts China's technology development, I think it is going to make it a little bit more difficult for China to do everything that it would like. At the very least, it is turning some foreigners and expats off the idea of living for most of the time in places like Beijing and Shanghai. And I think that will be at least a loss of potential talent that Chinese firms are able to hire.
Dan, I think that's a great opportunity to sort of segue into another risk factor facing Chinese manufacturing, Chinese supply chain, because it was just a few months ago that there was this thought that, okay, the big risk was just on the trade front. That seems to have cleared up. They got the phase one deal. Now, suddenly there's this, which is, as you point, could potentially change everything, or at least change the way companies around the world think about their exposure to China. But as you point out, and as you've been writing, the coronavirus is really not the only major threat to Chinese supply chains, Chinese manufacturing, and that there's another thing lurking out there that people need to pay attention to. So what is that?
So that is the current U.S. policy on how to restrict technology flows to China. And so there, as part of the trade war, there has also been a bit of a tech war hovering in the background in terms of U.S. policy action. I think the first major shot of that was last year or almost a year and a half ago now, when President Trump's administration designated ZTE to something called the Denied Persons List, which more or less cut off ZTE's entire ability to procure from American technologies, especially semiconductors. And so that has brought the firm to its knees, almost to the verge of bankruptcy, until President Xi and Trump reached a political solution to save the company. So there has been this element hovering in the background of the U.S. exercising investment restrictions on the ability of foreigners to invest in U.S. firms, especially technology firms. There has been a process initiated by the Department of Justice to scrutinize Chinese actions much more closely in terms of trade secret misappropriation, but also Chinese activities in, say, universities working with certain professors. And then it has also manifested in specifically this issue of Huawei becoming a large player in the tech world. And then the administration is thinking much more carefully now about how to deny products, American products, to a firm that it considers a national security threat.
What would be the impact on China's tech industry if the U.S. does actually go through with a lot of the things that it's threatening? And what options does China have to offset the impact of those curbs?
I think the issue right now for China is to figure out how to de-Americanize the supply chain. So, again, this is sort of a supply chain story in which the lack of a few components can really defeat system. So if you take a look at your smartphone, it has something like 1,500 different components in it. And if you lack even three or four different components, the whole system might be defeated. So your phone needs, for example, a battery, it needs a processor, it needs memory chips, and it needs a screen. And if you don't have these, then you don't really have a phone. And given that the U.S. has figured out that it is almost a monopolist on very important technologies, especially the semiconductor, and by denying U.S. semiconductors to particular firms, previously ZTE, it has figured out it can really cripple China's technology advancement. Now, I take the view that over the long term, China, now that has realized it is very dependent on U.S. technologies, it should be able to figure out a lot of its own technologies in turn. So it's difficult to name in history a country that has monopolized a key technology over the long term. So in the 18th century, when the UK was the leading industrial power at the time, and when it tried to export control certain textile mills and machinery to the US, the rising power, certain people just memorized a bunch of mill designs, gone onto a ship, and then went to the U.S. So one of these people is Samuel Slater, who's known in the U.K. as Slater the Trader, and stateside as the father of the U.S. Industrial Revolution. A lot of knowledge just consists in people's heads and transfers. I used to work in Silicon Valley. The saying that we had there was that knowledge travels at the speed of beer, beer or coffee, pick your poison. And so long as you can just talk through these sort of things, a lot of technology is able to travel. The Chinese don't have to invent anything de novo. They only have to replicate existing processes, but that is still a pretty big challenge. The U.S. is basically a monopolist in very many key semiconductor technologies, including the capital equipment to actually fabricate the semiconductors, and also in things like aviation engines, in which China is also trying to catch up. And so this is why there has been a pretty active debate in the White House on how to actually restrict a lot more technologies to China while also being able to protect the ability of U.S. firms to sell goods to their largest market and then also generate the revenue for greater R&D.
It's so interesting just sort of thinking about the symmetry or the asymmetry, or I guess it's the symmetry of the needs and priorities of China when it comes to trade and the needs and priorities of the U.S. when it comes to trade. Obviously, we know President Trump feels that he would like to bring back jobs from China, and though maybe, you know, it's debatable whether anything that's been done so far would really accomplish that. Obviously, that was a key driving aspect of his campaign and his message and so forth. And then you have the Chinese economy and the Chinese priorities that you've talked to us on the podcast before. And it's not about jobs per se. It's about the over-reliance and, you know, winning back the tech war against the U.S. So it's really sort of the same thing in a sense of both just wanting to not need the other.
Yeah, that's right. So both countries are trying to reach the upper preserves of technology, which is right now mostly an American affair, and the Chinese also wanting many of the same things.
So I guess then my question is, you know, obviously, you know, in the first half of the conversation, you were talking about, okay, U.S. companies are going to think about geographic diversity for manufacturing. And of course, during the trade war, we heard a lot about Vietnam. But there's really no country immediately that can just suddenly absorb a huge influx of new demand for manufacturing. I mean, there's just all kinds of things that need to go into that. It's not like you just build a Foxconn in Vietnam overnight or a Foxconn in Brazil overnight or anything like that. Who wins the race? Like, how long, say, will it take for China to accomplish what it needs on sort of, being able to design some of its own semiconductors so that it can wean itself off of U.S. tech?
That's a great question, thinking about it in terms of a race. And I tend to think that the U.S. has the advantage here. It is a lot more straightforward for Apple to move most of its supply chain out of China and into, let's say, a mix of places that include India, Brazil, and Vietnam, than it is for China to figure out semiconductors, which are the most complex technologies in the world. When I think of something like a semiconductor manufacturing equipment from a firm like ASML, basically these pieces of machinery are about as large as buses. Each machine costs about $200 million U.S. dollars. And you're really playing with light and physics and math at that point. It's almost like a pure science affair. And the Chinese just have not had enough experience really doing a lot of these things. Now, the question then becomes, when the U.S. exercises these export control actions on China, does it accelerate China's technology development or does it really cripple it? I think all over the long term, it should still be accelerating China's technology development. So right now, the Chinese have always had a program to replace its own internal the technologies that it uses with Chinese made equipment. Part of that has always been a program that has somewhat accelerated in 2013 after the Snowden revelations of different spying. And I think the Chinese now are, this is the difference in the last 2 years is that this is no longer a whimsical government effort, which has never really been terribly successful in the past. Now this is led much more by private companies, by firms like Alibaba or Tencent or Hikvision or Xiaomi that are asking themselves, can I depend on American supply such that I'm willing to build my technology off an American stack for the next 10 years? And they are becoming a little bit more hesitant to do something like that. And so they are taking the lead in trying to develop the more homegrown, more politically dependable component.
So, Dan, just to sum it all up, I'm kind of curious to get some of your personal observations about the situation at the moment. What has surprised you about how the coronavirus or the containment efforts around the coronavirus have impacted either the tech industry or the electronics industry? What was most surprising?
I think the speed and scale of the containment efforts. I think after Wuhan was quarantined, first of all, they quarantined Wuhan really quickly. And basically, there has been a really enormous demonstration of state power here and state capacity here. And I think they're now trying to figure out, given that there are some encouraging signs that the virus is abating, the number of infections ex Hubei has been in the double digits, I think, for the last 3 days, meaning that the epidemic seems to be mostly contained in Hubei and Wuhan. And the question now is really how to restart the economy. So they have been really good at making sure that people are in their place and that the state has the ability to quarantine very many people. Now, I think the interesting point to watch is how quickly they can reverse a lot of these restrictions to quell everyone's fears, and then really restart the economy because a lot of things are just halted now.
Well, Dan, really appreciate you joining us. Always love chatting with you. And we should probably, you know, do one again maybe in 3 months or 6 months and just sort of reassess where things are on the supply chain and the degree to which the industrial economy has been able to come back. But Dan, thank you, and hope everything returns to some semblance of normalcy fairly soon.
Thanks very much, Joe.
Thanks so much, Dan. It was really good. So, Joe, I found that conversation really, really interesting. It's nice to dig deep into the supply chain issue. And I do think there seems to be a sense out there that they can be very flexible and they can be reoriented as needed. But as Dan pointed out, they're actually quite complex and it takes time to move these things.
No, there are so many things that he pointed out that I hadn't seen anyone discuss before thinking about. So, for example, Christmas shopping or holiday electronic sales, that seems like a long time from now. But if the basic prototyping of the next generation of any products is Q1 and Q1 is looking like for sure a total disaster, then, even if there is a big economic rebound in Q2, which we don't know for sure yet, but even if there is, there will be inevitably this cascading effect that lasts at least through the year, and that to some extent there's no getting back this lost time.
Yeah, and the other thing I've been thinking about is we were just speaking about the production side of things, but you would think that the coronavirus outbreak is going to end up having a very, very large impact on consumption as well. So China is basically in for both a supply and demand shock to its economy. And I also wonder, when it comes to the consumption decline, how long is that going to last? And is it going to be similar like supply chains in that it takes a while to get back to normal? You know, the Chinese government has spent so long telling people that they really need to make efforts to contain the virus. They have to stay at home. Is it going to be easy for them to lift those and suddenly tell everyone, oh, everything's back to normal, you don't need to worry anymore, to Dan's point in the last question?
Yeah, totally. Because, there's no cure. There's no vaccine that we have or anything like that yet. So to declare victory over the virus or to declare that it's been eradicated seems like an extremely difficult thing. And even after, people start coming back to work, it seems plausible that fear of a new outbreak or fear of just one person having it and spreading into a new super spreader situation could really change how people behave, at least for quite some time after the idea of any sort of imminent resumption of normal life, it kind of seems implausible.
There's so much going on. It's such an interesting story and really sort of unprecedented in many ways. So what a fascinating topic to talk about.
Hearing Dan talk about how there's someone who checks his temperature literally every three blocks. And as he pointed out, the state capacity required simply to set that up, I mean, it's just extraordinary to think about what has been done already.
Yeah, they're doing it in Hong Kong as well, though not quite on that scale, but certainly to get into the major office buildings at the moment, you have to get your temperature taken. So it's a big change. This has been another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Tracy Alloway. You can follow me on Twitter at Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Joe Weisenthal. You can follow me on Twitter at The Stalwart. And you should follow our producer on Twitter, Laura Carlson. She's at Laura M. Carlson. As well as the Bloomberg head of podcast, Francesca Levy, at Francesca Today. And check out all of the Bloomberg podcasts under the handle at Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card.
It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Hey there, it's Joe Weisenthal.
And Tracy Alloway.
And we are the co-hosts of the Odd Lots podcast. And we want to tell you about a new podcast here at Bloomberg we're really excited about. Money Stuff, the podcast.
That's right. Friend of the pod, Matt Levine, is teaming up with our other friend and Bloomberg TV host, Katie Greifeld, to bring the Money Stuff newsletter to life. Every Friday, Matt and Katie will dive into all the Wall Street finance and other things that make Matt's newsletter such a hit.
You can listen to Money Stuff, the podcast, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.